Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. The election this past Tuesday was, to me, besides just wonderful, it was surprising and revealing. I, like so many that I spoke with, was nervous. I'd heard all Nate Silver's confident predictions, but I couldn't accept it. After 2010, after 2004, after 2000, I couldn't trust the polls. Hell, I couldn't trust the voters or the electoral system. So when voters re-elected Barack Obama and Joe Biden and elected so many progressive congresspeople and passed progressive initiatives, I was pleasantly surprised, and much more than that, some of my confidence in our people was restored. Now, of course, it is up to we, the people, to make the most of what we did last Tuesday, to hold our elected officials' feet to the fire, to deliver for us as we delivered for them. My guests today are Rob Johnson and Cheryl Schwenninger, and we're going to talk about the election, asking things like, who are we as a nation, as a culture? What was revealed in this campaign and in this election? Where are we likely to go from here? What does the election mean? And in the broadest sense, we may talk about money, politics, power, media, culture, political parties, movements. And who are we at this moment in relationship to Europe, China, the Middle East, the rest of the world? And hopefully we'll talk a bit about the role of the United States going forward in the unfolding global story, that is the actual role, the ideal role, the evolving role of the U.S. Robert Johnson serves as director of the Project on Global Finance at the Roosevelt Institute. He recently served in the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. He also served as chief economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and was an executive producer of the Oscar-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side. He was a management director at Soros Fund Management and is now the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, funded by Soros to encourage and support a rethinking of the fundamentals of economics so that they take into account the role of human behavior, including politics. He currently sits on the board of directors of both the Economic Policy Institute and the Campaign for America's Future. Welcome again, Rob Johnson.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Okay, thanks, Rob. And this is a first, I think. You are on by phone from Dubai.
That's right.
Yes, I don't think I've reached quite that far afield before, so good to have you with us. And I have no idea, what time is it there?
It's 1 a.m. here. I just saw the clock.
So you're up late. Okay. Cheryl Schwenninger directs the New America Foundation's Economic Growth and American Strategy Programs. He was founding editor of World Policy Journal and served as director of the World Policy Institute at the New School from 92 to 96. He's the author with Walter Russell Mead of A Financial Architecture for Middle Class Oriented Development. Welcome, Cheryl Schwenninger.
Yes, and I do know it is 405 in New York.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. And you got the easy one. Well, thank you both. And this is, Cheryl, this is your first time. Is Michael Lind the co-director of that program I just mentioned, Economic Growth and American Strategy Program?
Yes, he's the policy director of the Economic Growth Program and heads up our next social contract initiative.
Okay, and he's been on with me a number of times. This is your first time, so thank you for joining us. And now, let me also say that as Rob knows, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So, Rob, first, a bit about your path to the Institute for New Economic Thinking. And we saw you spent time on a Senate Banking Committee, time managing a big fund for Soros, and now you're doing this new thing. How do you see yourself getting there?
I would say I started as a young man at MIT as an undergraduate, and I was inspired to become an economist. I originally wanted to be a boat designer, naval architect, and Charles Kindleberger recruited me to economics as he was working on his book, Mania's Panics and Crashes. And from that influence, I guess I would say I started moving towards economics with the idea of financial instability, politics, institutions, and history being at the center of it. And whether I worked in the government or whether I worked in the fund management business, we see these patterns, which were not in vogue with the economics profession, but meant a lot to my sensibility or my yearning to understand things. And so when the TARP legislation came down, and it was so demoralizing, essentially the financiers who frustrate what people want in all walks of life, healthcare, education, infrastructure, snapped their fingers and got $800 billion and did not submit to being governed in the sense of a new regime of regulation, constrictions on their bonuses, compensation, and dividends. I sensed it was going to be very, very demoralizing. And at that time, a number of people, including Willem Bouwder, who's now at Citigroup, but was at London School of Economics, George Soros, Kolesky, myself, Bill Janeway, and others, we could see the despondency and the disorientation that would ensue and decided to find INET to address that challenge.
I must say, Rob, I hadn't heard that particular piece of the origin, and it is interesting to me that it was actually after the crash and after the initial response to the crash that you said, whoa, I imagine what you said was, whoa, given that crash, is this the response?
Yeah, and I would also say all of us had this kind of heterodox political economic perspective in mind, but the dreadful response to an enormous crash created what you might say the social conditions for a reawakening and reexamination of the fundamentals of economic theory, because as things went down, they were so unsatisfactory and so unpalatable for the people of this country and also people around the world. There's an awful lot of dissent toward what you might call the fundamental economic logic and model and practices in the United States, all over the world. INET receives tremendous amount of energy, support, curiosity, enthusiasm from every corner of the planet.
Okay, and so now just again, before I turn over to Cheryl and then before we launch into talking about the election, give people a sense of what the Institute on New Economic Thinking is doing, and the last time we spoke was almost about a year ago, Rob. So what is its aim, and then how is it moving these days?
The aim is to cultivate a new leadership in the realm of economics with a 20-year time frame in mind. To cultivate our target audience is young people, young scholars, prospective young scholars, who see a need to what you might call strike out on a different path than the quantitative, technocratic, and sterile economics that's come to define the mainstream. And it's our hope through amplification of their ideas and views, through funding of their research, through convening, that we will build a community, and that community, how would I say, will give its members strength and enlarge its membership over time and set economics onto a different trajectory than it otherwise would have been.
Okay, and the part that I recall from our past conversations and as I've been watching you over the period since its institution is this notion of a 20-year time frame, which I think is real important for people to hear. One, that you guys are in it for the long haul, and two, that you don't think something like economic thinking changes overnight, and three, that a lot of what you're doing is cultivating young people in the field.
That's right. Well, it's one of the famous physicists, that might have been Niels Bohr, who said that economic progress in science comes one funeral at a time. you need to discover things, and you need older people to move on so they're not defending old ways of doing things from positions of seniority and power before a discipline can evolve.
Okay, now that's the voice of Rob Johnson. I'm Terrence McNally, and I am going to reflect on this past Tuesday's election with Rob Johnson, executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and with Cheryl Schwenninger, who directs the Economic Growth and American Strategy programs at the New America Foundation. To learn more about each of their work, you can go to INET Economics, INET Economics, one word, .org, for Sheryl's work at newamerica.net. Sheryl, your turn. Your path to the work that you do today, and this is your first crack at it. Feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Well, if I have had a consistent theme in my work and career, it has been sort of following the historical forces in the sense of trying to understand and counter why conventional wisdom, conventional mainstream thinking has not been able to understand the implications of deep structural changes and historical changes, whether in international relations, the international economy, domestic society. And often, in fact, there is a concerted interest, a political interest, that for their own well-being obstruct a proper understanding of these historical forces and therefore distort our political understanding such that we get mainstream consensus that are actually horribly damaging to American society and the larger public interest. So my career really began with the launch of the World Policy Journal, which was devoted to, two principal themes, which was understanding the historical changes that were beginning to take place in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, the inability of the communist system or the Soviet system to be able to respond to the post-industrial imperative, the demands of a new generation for openness, for perestroika and glasnost, and therefore the delay in the American mainstream that would have interpreted those events as a historical opportunity to bring a very costly and unnecessarily dangerous Cold War to an early conclusion, and releasing human and economic resources for the betterment. And then we went into the 1990s, and we had a similar mainstream misinterpretation of the implication of historical forces with the new economy, which took the form of a neoliberal globalization, the fusion of a liberal American economy with essentially mercantilist East Asian economies that would in the late 90s and on into the aught years create these huge global imbalances that would culminate in the credit and housing boom as we got excess global savings recycled to the American credit market to make up and a debt boom that was needed because wages and incomes for working Americans had been stagnating for a decade or two. And then with the collapse of that bubble, we have now been dealing, and Rob and his group has been doing extraordinary work on this. We're dealing with the post-bubble deleveraging, global deleveraging process. And again, conventional wisdom has set in Europe and the U.S. in a potentially very destructive way. We've been able to avoid some of the worst of the conventional wisdom, but unfortunately, in the post-election period, that conventional wisdom, which is focused around Bowles-Simpson and doing a grand bargain, could in effect condemn us to 10 to 20 years of even lower living standards for the great majority of Americans and keep us in a deflationary, recessionary environment for an extended period of time. So during each of these three major historical periods, I've been in work involved in project that has been trying to, if you will, arbitrage the difference between the conventional wisdom, which is horribly wrong, and what the realities actually require and suggest. And this is why this post-election period is actually so critical. because it could be that the second great try at globalization will end it like the first great try did in a serious extended global depression and tears and all the other problems that you come when you have a global deleveraging cycle as serious as the one as we're now experiencing.
And just to check on that last point, when you say the second attempt at globalization, you're talking about the pre-depression. The pre-30s depression was the initial attempt at globalization?
Yeah, had a great globalization that took place from the late 1890s, 1880s to 1929 and 30, which, you know, international trade and finance became increasingly globalized. The privileges of the financial elite, took on their extensive ability to move money and capital around the world and create an interlinked debt and banking system. That all came crashing down when you had the credit installed collapse in Europe, partly because of a very bad Versailles kind of settlement, which you imposed austerity and debt on the losers. So, you know, the result was a depression in World War II, where it took a war to create the levels of public spending and to eliminate the overcapacity in the global system, as well as get rid of the debt.
Right. Okay. So I just wanted to make sure that listeners were aware of what you were talking about when you said this was the second attempt at globalization. The first was that period, and we saw what happened then, and now we're in this moment that we're in right now. The thing that I see that certainly links both of my guests, Cheryl Schweninger of New America and Rob Johnson of the Institute for Neuroeconomic Thinking, is this response to conventional wisdom, whether conventional wisdom be conventional economic wisdom or conventional wisdom even broader than that. But that's what both of you definitely have in common. Do you agree, Rob?
Yeah, I would say the other thing we tend to agree on, and I think I learned a lot from Cheryl's work at the World Policy Institute when they started, is that context matters. The real problems, the real institutions, and the real vested interests of any given time matter to how these things are addressed, how they're debated, and how they're to be understood. This is not about universal laws like sitting in an electrical engineering laboratory at MIT. These are subjective, psychological, historical, unfolding phenomena.
Very good. That's the voice of Rob Johnson. And I'm Terrence McNally. We're going to reflect now on Tuesday's election with Rob, director, executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and Cheryl Schweninger, directs the Economic Growth and American Strategy Program at New America. Their two websites are INET Economics, I-N-E-T Economics, one word, .org, and newamerica.net. Okay, let me go right back to you, Rob. I said at the top I was surprised. I found this election surprising and revealing. Were you surprised, and if so, what surprised you? And I will allow you also, if you want, to include the campaign in terms of the election, if you will.
Okay, number of things going back to the campaign surprised me. It surprised me that an individual with the reputation of Mitt Romney for restructuring companies, which that's a technical, essentially reducing labor, shedding labor, and extracting money through issuing debt and pulling out fees for himself, at this time, in this challenge to American society with a faltering economy, why would the Republican Party ever put, with that experience and those credentials, up as their lead person? And second thing that surprises me is how did he ever get as close as he did in the public opinion polls, given that record? I find that very, very disconcerting.
But it sounds to me that what you're saying is that those factors surprised you more. The across-the-board victories for Obama, Biden, and when what I point to as even perhaps more surprising, surprising for me on that score was how early it was settled. But surprising to me was the return of Sherrod Brown, the election of Elizabeth Warren, the election of Tammy Baldwin, the election of Tammy Duckworth, the election of others across this country, where certain very outspoken Tea Party folks were tossed out, and it seemed like America sort of came to its senses in a way that I hadn't quite anticipated. Rob first, and then
you could draw that inference, yeah, and you could also say that money in the super PACs did not work in terms of its persuasive power as much as many people feared it would.
Exactly. That was part of what created my nervousness, was just the unlimited spending. So let me go to you, Cheryl. Surprised by elements of the campaign or by the results?
Well, I do concur that there are some hopeful signs in terms of progress being made. You know, the ability of Sherrod Brown to survive the onslaught of enormous amount of money that was thrown into the Ohio Senate race certainly is encouraging, as is the election of Elizabeth Warren, as is some signs that driven partly by demographics, a new Democratic coalition. What worries me, however, is that even though that super PAC money did not work to ensure Romney's election or even win on other particular candidates or issues, it nonetheless still controls the game. The larger, Rob referred to the larger context, and this is what I think we have to be concerned about, is that the election, the agenda of the election was still largely set by the right and the center right and the plutocracy. And the plutocracy, even though it didn't win in the sense of getting its candidates elected, did, however, still prevail in terms of determining the agenda. We didn't focus that much on the kinds of growth-enhancing investments that we need to make in our public sphere and our public capital. We didn't focus on government programs that would have put large numbers of people back to work. We did not focus on wide-scale debt relief and you know, how you keep a housing recovery going. We didn't focus on how you begin to create good jobs to rectify the largest decline over the last 4 years in medium household income. And now we are turned, after the election, to focus on a grand bargain which has at its centerpiece an agreement of a framework of Simpson-Bowles that is based on a growth strategy of the last decade or two, essentially a supply side, lower the rates, although we'll broaden the base, and cut government spending and cut future necessary pieces of our social contract and our social security and Medicare system. So while there are some things to be optimistic about, there is worrying that we're still playing the game of supply side economics and plutonomy, not the kind of middle class oriented growth economy that we need to see.
I so agree, and this is obviously, I just would love you to chime in, Rob, but obviously it is striking to me, and you suggested, Cheryl, that it's the agenda put out by a lot of the media and an enormous amount of money that this is what's most important. But the fact that we go from an election where people voted progressive, people voted for we're all in this together, people voted against the Ryan budget and the Mitt Romney persona and experience, and then immediately what next is now this fiscal cliff created by the House Republicans. That does seem bizarre. Rob?
I think what is also bizarre, when you talk about what was surprising, and Cheryl really underscored this, is we went through an entire election where both candidates didn't really talk about the economic problems our society have that are so persistent and grave. And, you know, you would think, for instance, Occupy Wall Street didn't happen. You would think that the mortgage overhang that hasn't been resolved in 4 years is not worthy of discussion. And what is omitted from the debate, Joe Stiglitz and I recently went and talked to one of the major television networks about why we thought their coverage was off. And they turned around on me and they said, why do you think we're off? And I said, because you don't cover the economy, you cover a political election. Both candidates are euphemistically appealing to the 1% for fundraising, and you only cover the spectrum of economic issues that they entertain, which is so far removed from what matters to the American public. And I think it's the most daunting thing about this election, that those issues are not addressed, and then we turn around and we have this artificial construct called a fiscal cliff, which is a synthetic creation of a disaster when we don't have a fiscal disaster anytime in the near future, and we do have a jobs crisis. I think this is overpowering.
I said bizarre. I think there's a sense in which this is almost madness. Fiscal cliff, just for people who are beginning to take the word in stride because it's being mentioned all the time, basically, see if I've got the construction right. Extending the debt ceiling is something which, if I'm not mistaken, happened 19 times during George Bush's 8 years, with no fuss, no bother, and then becomes an issue, a shall we shut down the government issue, shall we default on our national debt issue with a radical GOP House of Representatives. The solution at the end of that, in quotes, the solution in quotes at the end of that battle was this agreement to provisionally agree to, if they did not reach a larger deal, that there would be taxes would be reduced. No. Taxes... The taxes would be reduced and cuts would happen to defense and across the board. Am I correct that that was the bargain?
The bargain was that you had the sequestering half of military spending and half of domestic spending, automatic spending cuts that would take place if you didn't come to an agreement before December 31st. At the same time, you had many of the tax cuts were extended, including the payroll tax cut, and those were agreed to be extended through, again, December 31st. So the fiscal cliff refers to the fact that you're having all the major tax cuts, both the Bush tax cuts, both for all income groups, expiring. You're having a variety of business investment tax cuts expire. You're having the very important for working class Americans, the payroll tax cut expiring, at the same time that you're facing the automatic spending cuts in both domestic and military spending. Now, the notion of cuts in military spending was supposed to bring the right or the Republicans to the table in a more honest way, but I don't know if it's worked out that way.
Exactly. Yeah. In other words, that was the negotiating victory, if you will, of this bizarre agreement, which was that since a lot of the cuts would happen to defense, that the right wouldn't let that happen, and so they'd negotiate in good faith. This, as we all said, what's happened is election tells the president, tells the Congress, tells the media, who's been ignorant of it, that Americans are not who we said they were, and Americans did not vote the way we thought they would, if you will, and that they are more progressive. They do seem to be, if I would say, certainly to the left of the presidential candidates of either party, and yet the big news following that information telling people who America really is that we've got to now fight a battle on the congressional Republicans' turf. I think we all agree that this is bizarre and this should not be happening. But given that it is happening, let me ask each of you, what's the best we should hope for, and how can listeners attempt to make some sort of impact on this? Who wants to go first?
How can listeners make an impact on this fiscal debate?
I mean, what should the people be doing? We've got a month and a half here before those things happen. Is there anything that the people voted last Tuesday? Is there anything that people can do now to see that their vote is not twisted into something ridiculous? And B, that second part was what is the best we can hope for in these negotiations?
Well, I would first off say that the next intervention point electorally is in the House of Representatives in 2 years. And because of proximity, if I were, how do you say, American citizens, I'd be climbing all over my House members to stop this craziness. That, you know, back when Bob Rubin and the Rubinomics types tried to say we need to do something about health care and entitlements, they said it in order to get more space to do short-term stimulus jobs programs, infrastructure buildup, and perhaps an infrastructure bank. And now they're into the cutting. But they dropped all of those things in the short to medium term that help American people get back to work. Idle resources don't pay taxes. Bringing people back to work, stopping skills from atrophying. All of these things are very, very salient. The other thing is, as you know, in California, about $1 in $3 in state and local budget come from the federal government. The federal government cutoffs are leading to layoffs in law enforcement. I've seen statistics around Sacramento and Stockton, California, where the rate of crime and the rate of gun shootings and so forth is exploding. So I think the American people have to become more outraged at this point. I think they have to appeal. I think they have to protest. And I don't think they can afford a celebration that what you might call the least worst candidate, to use the term of Ralph Nader, triumphed in the presidential election. Because Obama set the stage, and Obama's people who brought him back to office are the people who are about to get flushed if the grand bargain takes place along the contours that have been advertised or leaked in the media.
What do you mean by flushed?
They're the people who are going to bear the brunt
of
lower Social Security benefits later in life. A lot of economic analysts of Social Security have recognized that the people who need Social Security, let's just call it the lower half of the income spectrum, do not have longer life expectancy now. So delaying the time at which they get Social Security is just a benefit cut.
Right.
In fact, their life expectancy is declining in many of those
groups.
And you both raise that point because one of the arguments from the folks that, let's call them, all the people circling around the Peterson Foundation, and the folks who claim that debt is our number one issue, will say that life expectancies are up and therefore people should retire later. Isn't the simple thing on Social Security, or at least the initial simple thing, just to raise the amount of income that is taxed? Payroll tax right now, everyone gets payroll tax up to $110,000, and anything you make over $110,000, you pay no payroll tax on. Isn't the simple answer just to make it go, you know, why not all the way up?
Yes, although I think actually an even fairer way is to tax unearned income as well as earned income.
I agree. That was going to be my next step. If you agreed with me on that one, I was going to say, and then why is investment income, capital gains, all of those things not taxed as well, as if payroll is the only thing that matters when it comes to Social Security?
Right. Can I go?
And the other thing I would say in the large here.
And then we'll go to you, Cheryl. Yeah, go ahead, Rob.
I was going to say, in the large here, you said, who gets hurt? A lot of the discussion Paul Ryan and others have brought forward is about rationing seniors. When you look at the United States in a comparative context, the World Health Organization ranks American health care services 37th best in the world. Yet we pay more than double what any other developed country pays per capita for health care. So we're getting low quality, much lower than Canada, the UK, France, Germany, or Switzerland, at more than double the price. The problem is to attack monopolies in insurance, hospitalization, and pharmaceuticals, and reduce the cost of delivering better care, not to cut off care. With the money politics that we experience, nobody wants to talk about taking on these monopolies because it threatens fundraising for the election. And that's at the level of House, Senate, and the White House. And nobody wants to take on those issues. So now we come to the fiscal cliff. Medical costs alone, if the United States had Germany's medical costs per capita and Germany's medical system, we don't have a budget problem. If you ask me what I would ask the American people to do, we need a rebellion about our health care system that is unyielding until we get this fixed. And that isn't meaning cutting back on the use of services. It's cutting down on the costs of delivering those services.
Right. The issue is not Medicare. The issue is health care costs. Cheryl, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to address your larger issue. And as much as I would think that the taxes need to go up on upper income and wealthy individuals, I think we need a dramatically simple idea and proposal to get us through the next 2 to 3 years, and that would be that we have, and in the spirit of some compromise, therefore, and to make it dramatically simple, is that we extend all tax cuts and forego all planned spending cuts until the unemployment rate gets down to 6%. Meanwhile, we begin the serious development of reform of the things that Rob mentioned, which is what Rob calls the medical industrial complex, our healthcare system that tends to have built-in healthcare cost inflation way out of kelter to what it delivers in any real value. And that we do that through both the restructuring of the healthcare delivery system, the eventual elimination of phase out of private insurance, but through all payer regulation that my colleague Mike Lind has. And Rob's exactly right that if we had the healthcare cost of other OECD economies, actually we would have a budget surplus in the future, not a major budget problem. Second, we begin with the reform. Third, we begin the restructuring of the U.S. military. There's still enormous excess spending and a need to further refine our strategy for the post-Afghanistan and Iraq wars, and the pivot to Asia isn't necessarily part of that refinement. And third, we begin to have a serious discussion of tax reform, not based on the Simpson-Bowles of lowering the rates and broadening the base, although I'm in for eliminating many of the tax expenditures, but moving to a system that is much more both pro-growth and progressive at the same time.
So it's health care, defense, and then taxes. There is so much more to talk about, but I really appreciate both of you joining me today to kind of bring some sense to, as you both said, we don't have time to celebrate. The people said one thing, the government's about to pretend you didn't and act on something else. People have to stay not just involved, but even more involved now that this big show is over. Thank you. That's Rob Johnson, Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and Cheryl Schwenninger, who directs the Economic Growth and American Strategy Program at New America Foundation. Thank you both. Keep up the good work.